Hi, I'm Phil Trigger. This is the Wordy Rapping Hood.
The Trigger Brothers are with us on RPPFM. We're inside the iconic Point Leo Trigger Brothers store. I want to know the story of the Trigger Brothers. You were considered, obviously, pioneers in surfing in Victoria, but I want you to tell me about the original Trigger Brothers, who started up a shop in Queenscliff, your dad and your uncle. Tell us a little bit about the original Trigger Brothers, Paul.
Well, we were living in Melbourne originally, in Richmond, and Dad and his twin brother moved to Queenscliff and started up a grocery business there. They'd previously had one with their father, Tom Trigger, in Richmond, but they all moved down there, and we were 73 Hesse Street, two-storey building. And even back when Phil and I lived there, it reached over 100 years old, the building, but it was a magnificent place to grow up in. We were very, very lucky. Went to a local school. And the business, being Trigger Brothers, when Phil and I started later, we just picked up on that Trigger Brothers. We even used the same old English graphic for our logo. So overall, we were very, very lucky to grow up. You know, I think in Queenscliff, you know, country seaside town, the trains used to come in. We'd get up to lots of mischief. We didn't actually learn to ride surfboards there, but we actually saw them come into the town probably in 1962, 63. And I can clearly remember my first vision was at the bus stop at Point Lonsdale. And I was with my older brother, Peter. Phil was still at the Catholic school, St. Joseph's, and we looked out the window of this bus, and all the kids ran across to the other side of the bus to see these guys surfing at Point Lonsdale inside on the old sort of planks, like probably 10 foot, 9 foot 6 long. So that was my first look at surfing.
We originally just got washed around on tubes, inner tubes of car tyres, and we'd get just picked up in the whitewater and washed around, and then we seen the sleds, the surf sleds they used to hire on the beach at the Queenscliff back beach. I thought we could get the Queen Anne table leaves out of the back shed where they had a few Queen Anne tables, and we got a hammer and smashed the ends off, and then we'd take them down the beach to the back beach, and we used them as body sleds sort of things. And then we got our flippers organised, and we became sort of body surfers. Yeah, we'd been in Queenscliff for I think 10 years, and they decided to sell the business, and we moved to Queensland for a month or 6 weeks, I think, over the school holidays, just to see what it was like. And we bought little Coolite boards from Coles for, I think they're under a pound or something like that. It was a ridiculous thing. We never stood up on those, but we were at Burley and getting smashed in the shore break and different things. And then they couldn't get the education facilities up there, so Mum decided we should be real close to school. So we ended up moving back to Victoria, Bond Beach, Haldane Street, probably five or six houses up from the school. So we'd walk to school pretty late. And I think Pete, the next year after we got back, he got into the Air Force and met up with some surfing buddies there. He ended up buying a board and left the board at home for some reason. And Paul and I, we used to share it down the bay. I don't know how we worked it out, whether who went first or whatever else, but there was some sort of thing going. And we got into our football jump, shorts, you know, like that was what everybody sort of used. There were no wetsuits or anything like that. So we moved on from there sort of thing.
Bond Beach, of course, is that world-renowned surfing spot.
The Bond Beach Ripple Riders, we were.
And it would only work when it was 20 knots on shore or something like that. Just take us through some of those early surfing days in Bond Beach, which for folk unfamiliar, sort of halfway, just a little bit up the Frankston train line.
We'd be at school at Bonnie High, getting towards the latter part of the day, 2 or 3 o'clock, you'd be looking out the window and just trying to gauge how much wind was in the trees. And if it looked like it was sort of like probably 15 knots and above, you knew you'd get a little surf down on the bay. So we'd rush home. The boards were so heavy that we had to carry them nose and tail, like Phil had take the nose or I'd take the tail, because otherwise the big long boards would get caught by the wind, and we'd get those over onto the bay. And sometimes we'd be disappointed. Sometimes it'd be so strong and rough that we could hardly get out. Like a lot of other people that rode Port Phillip Bay, you know, we thought our little spot with the Glade was probably the spot, you know. Brighton Baths was probably definitely better, and Williamstown and other places, but you know, because we love our little spot just close to home, you know, that's what we thought was good.
Phil and Paul Trigger are with us on RPP FM, the Trigger Brothers. We're inside the fairly iconic Trigger Brothers surf shop in Point Leo, one of the only still functioning surf shops where you'll still find a glasser and a shaper out the back making surfboards.
And the resin smell.
And the resin smell, which is all pervasive as you come into the surf shop, very authentic. The days in Bond Beach, so you're surfing Port Phillip Bay, and I'm curious about what you were actually riding and when came the moment where you thought, oh, hang on a minute, we might actually start making our own surfboards, because you started up the first business in Chelsea in the same neck of the woods there. Phil, can you take us through those early years?
I think it was just a progression. We just surfed the bay because it was there and we had no means of getting down the surf. I think we went down the surf to Point Leo once and we found a picture of that just recently on top of the hill here at Point Leo in 1965 or something like that. And Paul had just bought his second-hand board, so we actually had two boards. Peter, I don't know, he didn't surf that much. We always had his board, so he probably never got much of a chance. We actually went back up to Queensland for a holiday and we bought, because I'd had a job and had got a lot of money on the job, like it was, yeah, a lifetime sort of opportunity, and I was only 15, I earned a hell of a lot of money, and I earned a lot enough money to buy a brand new Merrin surfboard when I was in Queensland, and Peter bought one as well, and then when I got back, I bought a Holden for Peter actually to drive me down the surf, and then Paul, a year, or probably 6 months later, to drive me down the surf, because I was only 15 and a half, but that's how we sort of got back down the beach into surfing, and yeah, we just surfed all the time. As many times as we could get down the beach, we were down there. Once we got back from Queensland, we were just at the start of the big change in surfboard, the shortboard revolution, what they call it. And just by getting the saw and cutting a foot off the end of your board was a massive improvement. So we just sort of roughly knew the shapes and we shortened the boards by a foot and the boards went 100 times better, even though we had these brand new boards. And Paul had a brand new pike board. He got the saw and cut the end of it and it went better. So we were just on this incredible thing and it didn't matter what we did. So long as we went shorter, we went better. So we were lucky because one of our mates was a sign rider and he did all the handwritten logos and probably the first 20 boards for us, so that just gave us a little bit of, you know, professional look, but the grass jobs were still pretty rough. Greg was a local footballer that we played footy with and got into surfing with as well, and I think the football side of it just made us, you know, group together and be sort of a team, and Paul and myself just carrying those boards down the beach in the early days. You had to do it together. We physically couldn't get across Nepean Highway in peak hour traffic on a 30-knot westerly wind with two 10-foot-long boards. It had to be done together. So I reckon that's the grounding, and as well as the football, because we used to play football together as well and look after each other. And it was a bad game of football in those days. It was go out and kill as many as you could, and it was bad in me.
We weren't that bad. We weren't that bad.
You know, you'd always look after the other guys in your team, and it was a real team thing. Mm. And I reckon that's what we developed, and we carried into our surfing team with all the young kids around. We look after them in contest. The first contest we went in, the West Coast guys just dominated them, and we couldn't get a wave. And it was only until we brought our football aggression into it. Now, this is honest. We almost had fights in the water. I would paddle over the falls on top of guys, and it was dog eat dog. They'd set us up and just eliminate us from the contest, basically, out in the water. And it was only when we got aggressive with them that we managed to get results. And we got unbelievable results, yeah.
Phil and Paul Trigger are with us, the Trigger Brothers, and we're inside the Point Leo store, the Trigger Brothers store. And you're talking about the real formative years of Trigger Brothers starting to get involved in shaping and thinking about, as you've talked about, the shortboard revolution, going from the longboard to the shortboard.
Yeah, yeah, we're mainly shaping single fins, and then in the early 70s we're doing some twin fins, and we're probably taking the lead from what was happening interstate for sure, like from Queensland and mainly probably New South Wales at that stage. I think the energy and the passion we had for it just kept us going, and we didn't even think about virtually what we were earning, anything like that, putting money in the bank. We were just trying to progress our own personal surfing, and then we built a team around that. It was our love for it, I think, that's just made everything fall into place. Even from those early days, you know, when we got the very first surfboard, like, we just had fallen in love with surfing and we didn't get distracted. Phil and I both had a terrific sort of focus with the shop. You know, those early boards, as Phil said, they were pretty rough. But we there was one year when Phil and I both had probably as many as 15 or 16 boards each.
I had 24 and you had 22. It was a bit of a contest between us. But whenever we go down the surf, we'd go for surf for 3 or 4 hours or whatever, or as long as we could keep paddling. And we'd just go home and think, oh, we'll do a new board, you know. And because there was more of a market for second-hand boards than new boards, we had no trouble selling them. So we just, 24 I had, and I beat Paul, but I was there all the time. So
surfing in those days, we're talking about the early 70s, we're talking about surfing as being absolutely a lifestyle pursuit. The idea that it was going to turn into the multi-million dollar industry that we've seen surfing become was just beyond anyone's imagination at that time. Surfing, I guess, also was very much a counterculture kind of pursuit in lots of ways in terms of how people regarded it. How did you go thinking that you might be able to make a business out of shaping boards and selling boards? I mean, it was pretty out there, really, for the early 70s, particularly on this coast, the peninsula coast.
Well, I think it just grew inch by inch. We didn't sort of have any big fancy dreams at any stage, but just we worked hard. We worked long hours, but we still managed to do a lot of surfing. And it was just little bit by little bit. And at one stage, our mother said to us, "Well, what are you boys doing up there? You know, you seem to be putting a lot of money into the bank." And she might have even mentioned, "You know, you're not selling drugs, are you?" And, you know, I don't know how that could have ever possibly gotten to her head, but she was surprised. And she was sort of like, Mum and Dad sort of helped us, you know, like get that business going with the rent to get going. But before long, it was paying for itself. And it just, I don't know, we just seemed to cruise along, Phil, didn't we? Like we didn't have any special sort of dreams. Like we wanted to be very competitive. And I think we achieved that, you know, in competition. And that sort of helped more surfboards sell. You know, if the higher your profile is, the more likely you are for people to come and visit and buy a board, yeah.
Phil and Paul Trigger are with us on RPPFM. The Wordy Rapping Hood is the show. Tracy Hutchison here with you, and we're perched inside the Point Leo shop, the iconic Trigger Brothers shop in Point Leo. Just tell us a little bit about the openings. So we're talking about, I think, about the mid-70s that you ventured down here to Point Leo. Still gravel tracks everywhere down the back here of the Western Port. Yeah. What was the idea behind setting up here at Point Leo, Phil?
It was interesting because when we first opened Chelsea, Ted Bainbridge moved in with Paul, and they hatched the plan, or we hatched the plan, of opening another surf shop in Frankston, because Ted was in the bank and decided that he'd wanted to work in a surf shop. So we opened up a surf shop there, and then we decided that we'd really like a place down here on the beach. So we looked at all the land around here, and we saw there were two commercial sites. Actually, Mum wanted us to buy the Merrick's General Store for $45,000. The block here was $25,000 next to the General Store. It was only a commercial block around the area. So we thought, oh, gee, that's a real good spot. So we went and saw the farmer, and he was paying individual rates on his, I think he had 74 blocks here that was subdivided in 1911. So he needed the money every year almost. So we bought the block for the shop off him, and then when we couldn't subdivide it, we bought the block next door for me to live on. So we ended up making this move. Paul was already living in Balnarring, but Ted had started this thing off where we got the first shop with Peninsula Surf Centre. The three of us were partners. There was Harry Hodge, Paul and myself, and Ted. We put $1,500 worth each in, and we started that up. Harry Hodge was working for The Age or something like that as a reporter, and he said, oh, gee, we should make quick movies. So we made a couple of movies as well, Liquid Gold and what was the other one, Band on the Run or something. So that sort of got us into it. And then we just decided after all, we'd rather do our own thing. So we left Peninsula Surf Centre. We started the Peninsula Board Riders Club as well. That was another thing that we started because we thought that with Peninsula Surf Centre, if we got Peninsula Board Riders Club, we'd have a group of surfers there as well. So that was all part of the plan, or Ted's plan, I suppose. Was it Paul? Or Ted was pretty into different things, and we were just sort of followed on because we were there at the time. I think we went to Frankston next, and we had Arthur Bratt. He was sailing, windsurfing and a sailmaker, and Ted had got us into windsurfing. So we started to make windsurfers. We were the first guys to make windsurfers in Victoria. Arthur Brett was living on the beach at Frankston, and he became Australian champion, world champion in slalom sailing, and he ended up working for us and running our Frankston shop for us. So we had that little identity there, and, you know, that drew the crowd there as well with Arthur, because he knew everybody. So then we ended up going, we bought out Wavelength at the bottom of the hill at Sorrento, because they wanted to move into a new factory. So we moved down there, and Peter Wilkinson, our crazy guy that ran the shop at Frankston, at Chelsea, we moved him down there, and he just, yeah, he killed it. He just loves retailing and used to run around just selling stuff. He's just out of control. But he's an incredible guy, Pete. He was a kneeboarder that worked for us as well. Paul picked him up hitchhiking, I think. But we used to do 100 kneeboards a year, because he sold kneeboards to all the guys. And that's how it sort of grew. We got into something, and I got into sailboarding. We did, six or eight sailboards a week or something like that. And then nowadays we're into stand-up paddling, and we're selling stand-up paddling because it's unreal fun. Just anything to do with the ocean and riding waves. We're not really interested in paddling or sailing distances, but riding waves, no matter what form it is, whether you're a body surfer or anything, it's just the thrill of catching that wave, and that's what we love. Yeah.
Phil and Paul Trigger are with us, the Trigger brothers, the iconic Trigger brothers, very much part of the pioneering story of surfing, absolutely, in Victoria, but put in many ways part of putting Victorian surfing on the map nationally and internationally as well. Paul Trigger, Phil was talking about the formation of the Peninsula Board Riders Club, and you talked about those very strong community connections around feeling like you were building your own kind of community that was a bit like a football club. There was always a sense that you wanted to be part of a big community of people that also loved what you were doing. Is that something that sort of just happened by accident, or was there really kind of a sense of this being part of, you know, feeling like you were all part of celebrating something that you all loved together?
Yeah, I think originally, you know, we wanted to build a surf team. People would come, even when we were in the backyard, people would just come in just to see what we were doing, making the surfboards. And, you know, Ian Cochran, for instance, Phil mentioned, he was one of those. And then there were other good, you know, kids that became good surfers in the area. And so Ian Portingale won 2 Victorian Open titles. So they sort of came in when they were young, and we took them down, and then they'd get a car, and then they'd take some other people down. And it grew in that sense. But I don't think we had at any stage had a master plan, except, you know, we love making the boards, and the more boards we did, the better we felt about it. But, you know, there was this East Coast, West Coast competition. We did want to sort of build a strong East Coast, because at one stage there were no competitions on the peninsula, and there might have been one on Phillip Island, and there were probably 5 competitions on the West Coast. So we actually decided to get on the ASA committee. We were advised by Stan Cooper, the president of the ASA, you guys need some representation. So Phil and I and Ted, a guy called Robbie Mack, Peter Wilco, we all went on that committee, and we changed things. And we had a competition at Gunnamatta, and we had a competition, one of the first ones, which Phil and I discovered a photo of the other day, was at Point Leo. Yeah, so we wanted to have our little bit of home ground advantage, because when we went to Bells Beach to compete, it was harder for us because we didn't surf there every day. So in a way, you know, we did build this thing, but it wasn't sort of deliberately set out to do so.
I want you to tell the story about one of the secret weapons that you took to one of those contests at Bells Beach, and it was described by the chap behind Rip Curl as a kook connector, as I understand it. You were the pioneers of leg rope. Leg ropes, we're talking about, revolutionising surfing.
It was the most incredible thing ever, because one of our mates that Paul went to school with, Peter Hill, who's another crazy guy, he went to New Zealand, and he came back with this incredible idea of us making wetsuits. And Rip Curl had just started, but he'd sourced the rubber and everything else. And O'Neill, we were getting O'Neill wetsuits from South Australia, I think. And anyway, we decided, forget wetsuits. But then he told us about this thing where the guys were tying their boards onto their feet with a piece of string. Anyway, Johnny Wilson, who now owns Barlin, leg ropes and surf sports or whatever, he went down the surf in, I drove him down in Paul's Combi. Anyway, we had two bits of cord on the roof of the car that we tied our boards on with, and we thought, gee, we'll get a can opener. We'll just try out this thing. So we put a can opener and we put a hole in the fin and we got the cord off the roof, the blind cord that had no stretch or anything, just straight onto our feet, and we tied them on. And Johnny fell off on the first wave and he didn't lose his leg. So I thought, well, I'm safe. But that was the big worry, that we'd lose our leg. Anyway, after a while, we developed a handkerchief that we tied around them, pantyhose, dog collars, and there's one up here in the roof, a dog collar, just up here on that Valentine surfboard. Okay. You can see it hanging down, a twin fin made from the early 70s, but that has got knots in the cord so that your hands don't slip on the cord. But the incredible thing was, in the early days when we just had the nylon cord, you couldn't undo the knots in the middle of winter, so you'd have to cut the cord off. So each time you cut it, it got shorter and shorter. But Johnny and his mates decided, Ian Brett, they formed this partnership, and they made it out of Bunsen burner tube with 6 foot of nylon cord on 5 foot of Bunsen burner tube, and it absorbed the stroke. The extra foot just pulled through the cord and it took the strap, and they made their mother sewed the straps and everything else, and that's how they started. And they sold leg ropes all over the world and still do, yeah. They've done really well out of it. But when we went down to Bell's, all the guys on our team basically got them, and all the peninsula were using them, all these different types of leg ropes. We went down to Bell's and we paddled out, you know, and Claw's standing on the beach and he's jumping up and down calling us kook connectors, you guys are kooks, you know. Anyway, we took off on all these, like, it's probably 8 foot, massive surf, and we were just jumping off because we get stuck inside too far, or the big set came and we just jump off our boards instead of trying to push under them, and the board's always connected. Next contest, they banned them, and they were banned for 5 years, I think, and you'd lose your board at Rincon and you might as well just ride it off. It just washed up in the rocks and absolutely trashed millions of boards.
We did a trip to Sydney, and in New South Wales, no top surfers were using them. There was probably no one using leg ropes. And we paddled out at North Narrabeen. There was Ian Portingale, Teddy Bainbridge, Phil and I, and we all had our kook connectors on the leg. And we got out in the surf, and the top surfers of the time, like Cole Smith, Terry Fitzgerald, Mark Warren, they were all sort of laughing at us. And we all paddled in, took them off, and went back out. We were sort of humiliated. We were
embarrassed.
Yeah, embarrassed by all these top surfers. So, and then from there, as Phil said, like the Barlin people did a great job, and each year the leg rope got better, and then they passed them to be used in competition. It was a good thing in the long run.
Wordy Rapping Hood.
Wordy Rapid Hood.
Rapping Hood.
Rapping Hood. Wording Rapping Hood.
Wordy. Wordy.
Wordy Rapping Hood.
Yeah, so, hi, I'm Phil Trigger. This is the Wordy Rapping Hood.
Hi, I'm Phil Trigger. This is the Wordy Rapping Hood.
Brilliant.
Close?
Close enough. The Trigger Brothers are with us on RPPFM. We're inside the iconic Point Leo Trigger Brothers store, which is very much like a surf museum in lots of ways. You look at the roof and see some of the old Chelsea phone number there, the old 772 Chelsea phone number, and some beautiful old boards, original Trigger Brothers boards from that period as well. And preserving the history of your careers and your contribution to surfing has also been, looks like it's been pretty important to you, because you've documented it pretty well. How important is being able to come in here and get this quite visceral sense of the surfing history of the Trigger Brothers, seeing the boards here, smelling the resin that's here on site? Why has that been such an important thing for you guys to hold on to?
Yeah, I think it's exciting when we discover something, you know, old. And on the roof there, there's one board in particular of Phil's. And I was going through a lot of photographs, little negatives, and they're very hard to see. But I spotted a photograph of Phil in a competition T-shirt at Bell's Beach with that board standing there with two other competitors. And I thought, oh, this gold, you know, because it's rare you come across something that was very personal like that. And even we had Phil's board from 1974 when he came fifth at Easter Bells. And that board's in the photograph. We've actually got a photograph here right now, folks. You can't see it, but it's a photograph of Phil and I and Cocky in the doorway at Chelsea in about 1973.
The pin lines on the board, it was just incredible. I decided I needed to practice my pin lines. So I just spent hours and hours just taping up different things, and it's a really unique board. I'd probably copy the pattern off somebody else's board, I suppose, but just the lightning bolt little rail cuts, and the bottom is actually, nobody ever sees the bottom, but the bottom is just incredible as well. But the incredible thing was, this guy rang me up, a mate of ours from over the other side, over Ryeway, rang me up and said, "Oh, I've got one of your old boards," and it was George Lucas, and I said, "Oh, just leave it over at Sereno and I'll go and have a look." Anyway, I went down there, I've seen my old board I hadn't seen for 40 years, and I thought, this board is the most collectible board I've ever had. I'm never going to give it back to George, no matter what happens. It'll just disappear off the face of the earth. Yeah. So anyway, I've rung George up, and I said, "Oh, George, yeah, that's my old board for sure, yeah." I said, "How much do you want for it?" And he said, "How much do you want to give me?" I said, "Oh, $100. How's that sound, George?" And he said, "Oh, Phil, I know that board means a lot more than you than $100. And I said, "Oh, how much do you want, George?" And he said, $200. I said, "Oh, no worries, George." So he paid him the $200, and we've just got this, because it's in the picture, because it's just, yeah, really difficult boards that I made, and because I wrote it at Easter Bells, it's the most special board we've ever had, yeah.
So is that that one on the roof?
That's the one on the roof, purple, the magenta one with all the
yeah, ones. So yeah. It's a very bold magenta, magenta, yeah. with a gold flash through it. The Trigger Brothers are with us, Phil and Paul, and we're talking about the evolution of a surfing brand, an iconic surfing brand in Victoria. Phil, you were reminiscing fondly about an era of surfing that I guess is still looked back on quite fondly by surfing purists as the period of time before the big money got involved, before surfing was all about how you were going to perform in a particular contest and surf in a particular way to get all the kind of the big points that you need to get when you're actually surfing in a contest. What about the side of surfing, Paul, that has really kind of corporatized surfing in lots of ways? It's sort of gone from being a very pure expression of being at one with a wave and paddling out and enjoying it. And I guess over the period of time that you've been involved in surfing, you've seen that change. You've seen surfing become something that's a multi-million dollar business. Do you think surfing's the better for that?
I don't think it's changed at all, really. Like, I mean, Phil and I can still go out and surf with two or three or four people, and sometimes the people we're surfing with, they might be pretty average. But with surfing, you can go to work having just caught one good wave, and it makes you feel good. So a lot of times, you know, we surf before work, and it gives us this sort of state where we're on a buzz, you know. So it's crowded now at times, but there's still lots of other times when it's still exactly how it was. And even though our equipment's different, it's still you know, real, it's fun. It's just good fun. And you can enjoy it from so many different levels, whether you ride a 10-foot mallet bodyboard, you know, a high performance surfboard. There's all sorts of different ways of getting joy out of it. But I think, you know, for us, one of the reasons why we got better is we were risk takers when we surfed. I can remember we just go for it. We had a real go for it attitude. And even though I've always been scared in big waves, my brother and Ted and other people bring me up to that level where I have to get out there. It's a big wave. I've got to go. You know, it's your turn. You've got to go. And there's all sorts of different aspects. Phil's never had hardly any fear at all. I've seen him do things in the surf that are incredible, which I think, you know, I'd be shaking. But yeah, there's all these different aspects. And Ted, Tidal Wave Ted, big wave rider, he was nuts. He was nuts, and he dragged us along. But, you know, I think it's such an enjoyable thing to do. And it's got, even we go down there, sometimes it's raining, and it's great. And sometimes you're out there in the water, and it's hailing on your head. And you think, oh, this is just sensational. You know, so it's a beautiful thing to do. So many great aspects. At different stages, it's been called like an art form and all that. I think it's just a sport, you know, it's something great to do. You know, it's not that arty, I don't think, personally.
I think it doesn't matter what level you're at too. You just, the enjoyment of catching your first wave and catching your, I don't know how many waves are caught, we still get the same enjoyment, the same thrill of catching a wave and making it through. And I mean, I surf with a lot of people that can't surf now. You're just learning to surf. I take them out and down at Shoreham and different spots, and I see them and I get so excited with them making the waves as well. It's just, it's something that, you know, like, it's just a fantastic feeling. And I think anybody that I'm in Billabong, our new company that's taking over our Sorrento shop with us in partnership. They've got this, the incredible thing, only a surfer knows the feeling. That is such a good thing. It's just, that sums it all up, I reckon, yeah.
Between you, as the Trigger brothers, you've got 100 years of surfing between you, 50 years each pretty much. What do you think has been the key to the success of the Trigger brothers, and how much of that has been about being able to work together as siblings?
Well, getting back to the success, you know, like it has been harder in the last 5 years or so, but Phil and I have, you know, not everything goes right all the time, but we've never sort of, you know, we've probably lost some money, but we've never sort of been overly concerned about it. We've never been, can't sleep at night because we're worried about it. We're lucky that we're still in the business, and John, who works here, and Al, they've got that same passion as us, and they've been around it for a long time. So I think we're sort of, you know, we're very lucky. We've had this passion for it, and that's just keeps us going no matter what. And even if, like, Phil does a lot of, Phil takes people for surfing lessons, but he doesn't charge them. People come here and borrow boards from him, and sometimes we don't get the boards back. But, you know, we don't sort of tend to worry about all that little stuff. Yeah, we just...
I think it's just our passion, and we love it, and we like other people to share it. And, you know, like, if you can't share it with other people, it's just not happening. So we were lucky because we moved down here when properties were cheap, and my sons have both bought properties down here, like, unbelievably cheap. So I think there's always room for that local manufacturer, you know. Like, the big companies will do their thing. It's interesting with the Billabong, that they're taking over our shop at Sorrento. They were going to put another shop in there, so we sort of forced into a position where we had to go that way, but we sort of wanted to do anyway. But they're actually keeping our shop as a Trigger Brothers shop. They're going to make it into a sort of almost a museum with all our old pictures and everything, do a much better job on it than what we ever have. So it's sort of been a bit of a bonus for us. So
I think we've been able to work together. There's never been any real hassles. You know, I've done a different part. I've moved into a different part of the business, more kind of like retailing side of it. I've also got a pretty strong connection with the snowboarding. So there's, you know, I love doing that. And so, like, Phil had windsurfing. I didn't do all that much windsurfing. He's got SUPs, and I don't do that much supping, but paddling the stand-up paddleboards. Yeah, we've sort of been able to, you know, Phil mainly does manufacturing and probably a lot of actually promoting the business on the water. And that's really important. Like, you know, and I might be behind the shop counter up there a bit. We still get people at Frankston's store in particular, like, heaps of them coming in from Chelsea, and they'll say, oh, why'd you move the shop? Why did you get out of there? You know, that was a good move for us. But, you know, so there's still like a good loyalty that comes to us. And yeah, the business, it's been more difficult, but it still runs pretty smooth, really. And this is a good move for us. Like, Phil's got to be at least 65 or 66, and I'm 67 this year. You know, we're starting to have trouble getting to our feet sometimes. Late takeoffs. Yeah, the bigger waves are actually easier, but yeah, sometimes, you know. So I think it's going to be sort of, maybe we might be able to just relax a little bit more.
And Phil, it's not unusual to come into the Point Leo store, as I did just last week, to hook up this chat and find you covered in resin and dust, fixing up your own surfboard, putting in a new fin at the back of your surfboard. It still remains a great passion of yours, doesn't it, to be hands-on shaping and glassing the boards. You still love that.
Yeah, well, it's just being able to accomplish something. It's like the paddle boards and everything else, or doing, somebody brings in a difficult spray and John says, oh, that's going to take me too long. And I think, oh, 4 or 5 hours on a spray. Oh, yeah, that is too long, but I'll have a go at it. And I mean, people bring in things all the time that they can't fix, and I think, oh yeah, well, I'll have a go at it. It's just something, you know, you think you can do, and you have a go at it. Yeah. And I mean, making boards is just, if you can make a board, like, I had some guy ring me up. He'd bought a board here and he'd gone to Queensland, and he rang me up after he had the surf, and he said, that's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I thought, how good is this, you know, as if I'd ever do that to anybody. Like, so I rang up my dentist, and I said, because I'd had a bit of a problem with a root canal thing, so I decided to ring him up and thank him for fixing it for me. It just sort of flows on, and I thought, yeah, well, I can give this sort of ongoing thing. Yeah, it's just, yeah.
One final question to you both, Paul and Phil Trigger, and it's, and you've kind of answered it in many ways throughout the conversation, but what does it mean to you, I guess, to be able to have built a business? You sort of said you're proud to be from Chelsea. You're very proud of particularly this iconic store here in Point Leo, to sort of live and work and love what you do and love the place that you're doing it. That's a pretty rare combination to have been able to pull off, and you've done it successfully. You don't seem to me to be guys that spend a lot of time looking back, because you've been great innovators. But what is that, I guess, when you think about being able to have done that and being able to walk into this shop and know you can have a wave before work? What does that mean to you, and being able to do it on the beloved East Coast, not the West Coast?
Well, I think it's never been all about money for us, you know, like it's just been, you know, the joy of being near the beach. And we made those moves from that Chelsea area to live down here because we wanted to be closer to the ocean. And I suppose we'd been on the ocean at Queenscliff and we'd loved it there. But it was interesting, you know, we spent that time of our life at Chelsea, living, you know, just near the school and that. But as soon as surfing came along, you know, we just got hooked. And we'd had a lot of, we loved football, Phil and I. You know, we used to play a lot of junior football with some really good, in our team, we had three guys that ended up playing league football. And we loved that part of it. But the surfing, it was just so exciting. We just got hooked on it. And, you know, we're lucky to, we are this, because of our background, I think we were able to focus. You know, a lot of people back in the day, they didn't really prepare for surfing competitions and things like that. And I'm not saying surfing competitions are everything, but for us, you know, we like to compete. And so we had really good focus. We developed a team around us, and I don't know, just sort of, it just went along, you know, like it never sort of really, even now, you know, like Phil, like, you know, he'll glass a board, disappear for a second, he's gone down to have a paddle, just wash the dust off. I try to get in the water when I'm feeling really fit and healthy. I try to get in every day. We still surf bad days. I don't surf as many bad days as I used to, but even on a bad day, you can still get a bit of joy out there. So you just love it.
I surf every day. No, every day I can, even bad days. But I've got onto my stand-up paddleboard and you can go out in just about nothing. And it is just so relaxing. I think the whole thing about surfing is it's such an intense thing, getting hit by a big wave or even catching a small wave. It just clears your mind of everything. So you've just got this totally relaxed feeling when you come out of the water. Even if you've had an aggression out there or anything else, you come into the beach and it's just all finished. And yeah, you've got the day ahead of you, you've got your work ahead of you. Forget about what happened yesterday, how much money you lost or whatever else, what boards you broke, what boards you ran over in your car. It's you just forget it, and it's, yeah, you move on to the next day. Yeah, so I think that's what, and everybody that surfs, and I'm actually trying to get a group of war veterans from Taiab to come down and do stand-up paddling, and I've been at these guys for about a year and a half or 2 years now, and they've just come back to me and they said that the RSL guys are keen to get into it. In the meantime, apparently all the vets that return to America do surfing for a week. That's a compulsory thing that they do. They have to spend a week surfing with pro surfers or whoever in America, and that's what they're doing. And I think that's the whole thing is just relaxing, and it just takes your mind off your problems, yeah. Mm. That's why we love it.
I'm going to try this one again. What's been the secret of the Trigger Brothers' success, you two brothers?
Hard work. Like, we've worked hard. So from a business point of view, we've worked very hard. We put a lot of hours in. Like, we used to work 6 days a week, probably still almost do. So there's no real shortcuts. You got to work hard. And we're, you know, you talked about earlier about, you know, surfing royalty. We're street kids. We, you know, we grew up at Chelsea. You know, we never had a whole lot of money in our pocket, but we worked hard and built it up. It sort of went from there, but we've always worked very, very hard.
Phil and Paul Trigger, what a great story. What a fantastic opportunity to catch up with you both sitting in the Point Leo store. And we all wish you the best with the new incarnation, the new store, the new version of the store in Sorrento with partnership in Billabong. But you're still here at Point Leo with the big grey shark, the old grey nurse in the middle, and still in the business of making surfboards and doing great customer service, and lots of groms have been walking in and out of as we've been talking and shaking their heads at you too. Here you are, superstars on the wireless. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure, and we'll see you in the surf. Hi, I'm Phil Trigger. This is the wordy rapping hood.
Brilliant.
Close?
Close enough. So I thought I'd take Phil Trigger up on his kind offer to go surfing. And it's a beautiful morning. We're at Shoreham Beach, and it's fair to say, Phil, that the swell hasn't probably quite come up yet. But what do we got out here?
Well, it's the tide's just too low at the moment. Once the tide comes in, there'll be some probably 1 foot waves if we're lucky. And on these big boards, you can catch anything, so it'll be fantastic to have a bit of a go, yeah.
What have you brought down for me to try and see if I can go?
I bought a 9-foot hot dog stubby, which has got a fair bit of buoyancy. But if you struggle at all on that, you just hop onto a stand-up paddleboard, use it as a surfboard, throw your paddle away, use it as a surfboard, and you can stand up in that without waves. And that's the trick to it, yeah.
So you really do come out in anything. When you said you'd come out in anything, you really do.
I try to go out every day. It's just as a fitness thing. So when it's good, I'm fit enough to last as long as I can, sort of thing, yeah. So it's a training thing. It's like everybody trains for every sport. This is my training. You can't beat it.
You can't beat it. And it's a glorious day. And I guess that's that thing that, you know, it's just a question of getting out there. And that's part of the thing. And it is a beautiful sunny morning. Fortunately, because of the conditions, Phil, there's no one else around. So we've got it to ourselves. What are the things that surfers that you would have seen too in those very early days coming down here to Point Leo is that kind of great legendary thing that surfers who surf the break first get to name it. Are there any trigger, like, you know, quiet little secret spots that you and Paul have named and you haven't told anyone else where they are?
Most of them are known, but I have named a few, like Mystery Left at Point Leo. What was the other one? Hastings, which is a wider break at Point Leo where everybody surfs, just as a muck around. Summer Crunch is another one that we've sort of in between crunchies and sometimes. So that's another one. The breaks out here is it's pretty amazing because the left and right hander out the back is called Atlas, right across towards Flinders, the far south break. The next break across is Scunge Rock. And that's named after some guy. In the early days, all the Suicide Savages have nicknames. They're and we've got a list somewhere, but about 100 names, and they've all got nicknames. So he was called Scunge. I don't know what his real name is, but he put in for a board for one of the guys who just turned 80, and all the guys on the beach, or you know, like 10 of them, 12 of them, or something like that, put in for this guy who just turned 80. And he was struggling to stand up on his board, so they all put in, and we did a board absolutely real cheap for them, a ridiculous price. We got him back into surfing again, so it's a fantastic story. But, so I don't know who named pines, but I'd say it'd be named after the pine trees here.
Probably. You talked about the Suicide Savages. Who are those? Who are they?
A group of, one of the guys from Chelsea Yacht Club. He was sailing up there, and they all surfed, and they all got kicked out, and they formed this little group down the beach called the Suicide Savages, and they terrorised all the other surfers. A lot of people they wouldn't be allowed in the water when they're out there and all this sort of stuff.
Right.
But they named a real lot of the breaks. Yeah, mm. Cyril's down at Flinders is named after another one. Mm. They're the first guys down here, basically, yeah.
Yeah. So we're here at the Pines in Shoreham and about to have it all to ourselves, Phil Trigger, and I'm quite honoured to be going out surfing with you. What if you had your ideal choice of wave here down on the Western Port, what would it be down here for you?
Probably Cyril's is my favourite break, but you've got to climb down this rope ladder and it's slippery. It's probably a 500-metre walk through clay and muck, and it's tragic, and then you've got to climb over all these rocks. But the waves break there, absolutely incredible. You have to surf there on a really high tide because the rocks are so dangerous, but that is a real good wave. Honeysuckle Reef is another real good wave, one of my favourites.
Where's Honeysuckle?
Just across here. That's the next reef across. You can see exposed.
Yep.
So it goes the Pines here, Ugly Owls, which is a left-hander breaking back here, Little Noosa, and then it goes Honeysuckle, the Bombi, Second Reef, First Reef, and then we get onto Mystery Left down at Point Leo, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, let's go surfing, Phil. You
Send
said
it.
So, I'm puffed. I think I got wave of the day, Phil Trigger. I think this well came up. There was at least 8 foot there at Shoreham.
Well, a lot of people exaggerate the height, and there's a lot of people that underestimate it as well. I like to be somewhere in the middle, but it was a good 1 footer.
Oh, yeah, a good 1 footer.
You got probably, what, a 50 or 60 metre ride, so it's pretty special, yeah. And as I say, it's all to do with the board, the equipment. The bigger the board, the easier it is. You're allowed to cheat. You want to get it sorted out, and then you get onto a small board, yeah, if you can.
Well, Phil Trigger, it's been an absolute honour to be in the water with you. And I have to say, I think I saw something that doesn't always happen because I think you fell off.
Oh, I fall off lots. Sometimes I don't fall off, but other times it's just sort of, you're not trying hard enough if you're not falling off.
Well, so. Beautiful day as always on the bay, the Western Port. And thank you so much for being part of the Wordy Rapping Hood.
It's been fabulous fun. Thanks, Trish. Hi, I'm Phil Trigger. This is the Wordy Rapping Hood.